Welcome to the Kindle Chronicles, the Friday podcast all about your Kindle. I'm Len Edgerly, and this is episode 293 on Friday, March 14th, 2014. I'm back in Denver, but this week's show is going to focus mainly on South by Southwest Interactive, the mega tech gathering in Austin, Texas, that I attended for 5 days. I got back home here to Denver this week on Tuesday night. I had my Sony portable recorder in my fanny pack the whole time, the better to grab brief interviews with people that I hope you will be interested in hearing from. And as you can imagine, I was not the only person at South by wearing Google Glass, so I had a chance to attend a couple of events devoted entirely to wearable technology, as they're calling it. And you're also going to hear, as part of the audio interviews, the shorter ones, some provocative opinions about the future of the book, and a special segment of voices from the UK, which I recorded at a startup demo gathering of UK tech companies that was held at the Austin Hilton. But before taking you back to Austin, by the magic of podcasting, I'm going to take up one news item that you probably have already seen in your inbox. It arrived yesterday, Thursday, from Amazon. And for the tech tip, I want to make sure that you know about two software updates for both generations of the Kindle Paperwhite e-ink reader. And in content, I'm going to focus on two books by an author named Austin Kleon, K-L-E-O-N. He was the speaker at South by Southwest who made the biggest impression on me. In fact, I think the entire trip would have been worth it just to hear his keynote on the first day that I got there. I was wearing Google Glass when I stepped into his session without having any idea really what I was getting into. It was a huge room, Exhibit Hall 5, with thousands of people in it, and the guy on the stage was talking in a very calm voice as if he was giving just kind of a quiet college seminar, not some big bombastic motivational session. But I found what he was saying made me know that I wanted to go back and listen to it again, and I've bought a couple of his books. I apologize for the quality of the audio. Google Glass is handy because you can just start a recording while it's on your head, but it's certainly not going to compete with my Sony recorder for quality. But this will be all you'll hear this episode from Austin Kleon, although I'm hoping to have him as a guest on the show sometime in the future.
Don't just share your products, share your process. Think about what you know how to do that other people would be interested in learning. Think about what you have to contribute. When you teach someone how to do your work, when you let them work over your shoulder, you are, you know, in effect, generating more interest in your work. People feel closer to your work because you're letting them in on what you know. And of course, teaching is not a completely altruistic activity. When you share your knowledge and your work with others, you receive an education in return.
I'll have more to say about Austin Kleon when we get to the content section after the interviews. Let's turn now to the news and the tech tips. The news item that I'm sure most of you received in your inbox yesterday, March 12th, was a masterful example of concise corporate communication, I thought. In just 121 words, Amazon's Dear Len Edgerly email that I received informed me that the price of my Amazon Prime membership will increase to an annual rate of $99 when my current membership, which is costing me $79 a year, renews on November 3rd. There was no press release issue, just the email blast. I think it fairly pointed out that the annual price of Prime has remained at the $79 level since the program was launched in 2005, and that during that period, fuel and transportation costs have increased, and the number of items eligible for free two-day shipping has grown from 1 million to more than 20 million. Not to mention, of course, which they did mention briefly, unlimited access to more than 40,000 movies and TV shows and more than 500,000 books for free borrowing, one per month at the Kindle Owners Lending Library. If you don't have Prime yet, you can sign up for a new Prime membership until March 19th at the $79 price and lock it in for a year. This price increase was not a surprise because Amazon had told financial analysts that it was coming, and in fact it said that it might be as high an increase as $40 more a year. So a $20 increase didn't seem to shock too many people, and most of the reaction that I've seen, plenty of people don't like to see an increase in something like this, but I would characterize the overall reaction as fairly muted. TechCrunch, for example, posted an article by Matt Burns, teasingly titled, "What's the Best Amazon Prime Alternative?" And the lead read as follows, "There isn't one. Sorry, Charlie. Amazon Prime stands alone as the best deal online. No other service offers the same amount of substance. Free two-day shipping on a ton of stuff, cheap overnight shipping, and a streaming library second in content only to Netflix. Like it or not, Amazon Prime is still a great deal, even after the price increase it announced this morning." Amazon Student Prime members will pay $49 a year. That's compared with the current price of $39. Amazon's grocery delivery service, Prime Fresh, I think that's just available now in Seattle, Los Angeles, and San Francisco, and that costs $299 a year. I guess you get all the delivery of all the groceries you want for that, and that price doesn't go up in this current price increase. No word on whether there will be a price increase for Amazon's Prime Air 30-minute delivery service, which was announced on 60 Minutes in December, available, quote, in some number of years. There was actually no price listed on what that was going to cost. And by the way, whenever I look back at that video, which Amazon put out at the time of the interview, it's amazing to see what kind of viewership it's gotten. As of yesterday, it was over 14 million views on YouTube for the Prime Instant video with the drones flying from the factory to somebody's doorstep. Turning to the tech tips, no matter which generation of Kindle Paperwhite you have, this is the latest e-ink reader, just a fantastic reader with a built-in light and all that. They both got a software update. For the Paperwhite first generation, the new version is 5.4.4, and it offers Kindle FreeTime, that's the tool for personalizing profiles for kids, as well as Goodreads integration, Cloud Collections, Page Flip, which is a handy way to move through a book, enhanced bookmarks, highlights and notes, smart lookup using Dictionary, X-Ray, and Wikipedia, inline footnotes, and the very handy Vocabulary Builder, which tracks which words you look up in your dictionary when you're reading on your Paperwhite and captures them in automatic lists or flashcards to help you add to your vocabulary. The Paperwhite second generation update, which is 5.4.3, these version numbers get a little confusing because the second generation version is one digit lower than the first generation, 5.4.3 versus 5.4.4 for the first version. Anyway, the Paperwhite second generation update has a little different list of features because it already had some of the ones that the first generation is now getting. The new update for second generation adds the ability to access notes from the reading menu as well as via the go-to menu in the reading toolbar. You can also see all of your collections in the collections view and customize where your collections show on your Paperwhite. I haven't actually figured out how these changes in the collections work. I know Garrett Riley said he thought these are some really worthwhile improvements, but I've got to play around with it a little before I am completely comfortable with navigating the collections and which ones show on my Paperwhite versus on my other devices. It's a powerful tool, but I think it does take some getting used to really use it in all of its details. Other improvements for the second generation, there's reading PDFs is apparently going to be easier. You can pan and zoom more quickly and easily. I did try that. It did seem to move pretty quickly around a PDF, and you can adjust the margins of the page when you're reading a PDF. You can also view the price of a book from within the free sample and buy it with one tap, always making it easy to buy stuff. And conversely, you can cancel the purchase before the download is complete by tapping Cancel Purchase. If you wait long enough and you don't want to fool around with downloading this with a USB cable connected to your computer, the updated software should arrive wirelessly on your Paperwhite if you have it connected to Wi-Fi, maybe overnight or just long enough so that it does show up. If you do want to get it right away, just use the links that I'll have in the show notes at thekindlechronicles.com, and that's how you'll be able to download the updates to your computer and then transfer them to your Paperwhite with a USB cable. So the first segment I want to present to you from Austin, it all has generally to do with the evolution of the book, which of course is something that we talk a lot about here on the podcast. There was a session on Saturday morning provocatively titled "Emoji and Texting is Human Language Extinct." Emoji are the pictogram symbols that they developed in Japan, and if you have an iPhone, you might be using them or have seen them sometimes arrive on text messages. The smiley faces is the basic one, but you can also do little pictograms of jet planes or buses and all different kinds of faces with emotions. And so the session started out with images on the slides of hieroglyphics from Egypt and talking about how human language and the alphabet evolved from that kind of pictogram communication. And now the suggestion was by these two speakers that we're seeing a shift back toward it in advertising and how young people text. So it was a pretty radical idea that we are now actually maybe in the tail end of the use of print. I just found it fascinating. I don't expect this really to happen in my lifetime, but it did remind me of the Eric McLuhan's interview that I did. He was totally on this topic, predicting that the language is going to evolve in this kind of a direction. So I'm sure he would have been fascinated in this presentation. I was there at this session with Brian Person, a friend of mine who lives in Austin. I had breakfast with him that morning on Saturday, and then we went over to attend this. So I'll start out with his observations of the session, and then you'll hear from one of the speakers.
I'm Brian Person, and I'm based here in Austin, Texas, and I work for a company called Lithium Technologies.
Now, we both sat in on a session, Emoji and Texting is Human Language Extinct. What did you think of it?
I was surprised by a couple of things. One, that 10% of all tweets have emoji in it. I guess that surprised me. That seemed high, but it could be that that tends to skew still, I think, a little younger. So maybe it's more people that aren't quite as many people in my circle that are using emoji. But this whole idea of moving toward a more visual form of communication that Sam was really harping on, I definitely see that. And he was talking about things like Instagram and the idea that that we're using visual, images and photos and videos in a much more, I would say, compelling way than we were even a few years ago.
Do you see it affecting what we read on our Kindles?
I think maybe some of that content has to catch up a little bit with this trend, right? So maybe what I read on my Kindle tends to be more text heavy. Although a guy we both saw yesterday, Austin Kleon, he weaves a lot of visual communication into what he does. So I would love to see more of that.
My name's Ben Zimmer. I'm executive producer of vocabulary.com and also language columnist for the Wall Street Journal.
Now, your talk here at South by Southwest was sketching some fascinating changes ahead for really the way we read, the way we communicate. How soon do you think some of this gets into how we read books?
That's a great question. I mean, even though the e-book has taken off in a serious way, it's still very much in the traditional print medium. That's changing, of course, with the way that e-books incorporate audio and visual, and there are some exciting, I think, opportunities there. But our idea of the book still remains a traditional one. But I think that we're going to see a lot of innovation, and that kind of innovation is something that moves beyond traditional forms. But that's something in my talk I mentioned, for instance, Lawrence Stern and Tristram Shandy. Incredibly innovative for the time, still looks very innovative if you read it, the way that he was playing with the form of the book and the novel. And people are doing that now. We talked about the emojification of Moby Dick into Emoji Dick. That it's hard to tell what that might be indicative of in the future, but it speaks to the sense of play, the sense of creativity that people have with traditional forms. I'm sure that publishing companies are always fretting about what that traditional form will turn into. There are conservative forces at work to try to keep publishing the same as it always has been. But the innovation around the edges, I think, will sort of penetrate into mainstream publishing through ebooks, where there is so much of a possibility to transcend traditional forms of the printed page.
I would think this kind of experimentation would be much more likely to occur on tablets and the Kindle Fire, the iPad, than the e-ink readers like the basic Kindle.
That's probably true, but the e-ink reader is a good example of something that tries to capture what one experiences in the book as a printed object. I love books as printed objects. I've got lots of them. I'm not giving them all up to read ebooks. And I appreciate the experience that mimics that, but it has to at some point get beyond just simply emulating old forms. And definitely with tablets and devices that have the possibility for doing more than just creating that sort of imitation of a previous form is where the innovation is going to happen.
Last question. How quickly do you see this changing? Say 10, 20 years from now, you and I, people who love to read, still be looking mainly at words, or what do you think?
I'm never very good at predicting these types of trends, and certain things have taken off much more quickly than I would have expected. But at the same time, something like the ebook, that was germinating for a very long time before it really started taking off in a serious way. Now that it has, and now that we see the possibility for innovation, I would imagine that we're going to see a lot of that innovation happening in the next 5 or 10 years. It's a moment of uncertainty, again, for the traditional incumbents like publishing companies. There's a lot of uncertainty about where that future will lead and how they'll make money off of it. But it's an exhilarating time, too, because there are so many possibilities. The sky's the limit.
Those of you who have been listening to the podcast for a while may remember when I had my nephew, Stephen, as my guest up at Ocean Park. And he's a very bright kid on his way to applying for college now, who has never read a book. And I paid him $50 to read Ender's Game. And I just had this feeling that it was sort of a troubling thing to see a kid who was dared to say he just doesn't read books. He figures out other ways to be successful in school. And so this next speaker who I found on the South by Southwest program, Ed Castillo, he made a whole session out of the fact that as a high-functioning guy at an ad agency in New York and a graduate of a good college, he has not gotten his knowledge through books either. And I find this fascinating. When you let yourself play with how we read, how the way we read books is changing, and then you go all the way to, maybe there's going to be information flowing into our lives that doesn't even come from books. I'm not sure how I can explain why I find this such a fascinating topic, but I really enjoyed my brief encounter with this next speaker, and I hope you will too.
Ed Castillo, Chief Strategy Officer, TBWA, Chiat/Day, New York.
What was the title of the talk you just gave here at South by Southwest?
Why Reading is a Flawed, Dying Technology.
Did I hear you right that you've never read a book?
Cover to cover, no. A proper book. I've tried. I've done a lot of reading, but I can't say that I've read a proper book cover to cover in my life.
But you did graduate from some schools.
I went to a little college called Amherst College, did some graduate work in philosophy, listened very closely to my professors and all the smart people around me. That sustained me.
Now, this podcast is for people who love to read on Kindle and ebooks. People who've made the shift from reading on the page to reading on the screen, so they think we're kind of innovative. But
sure.
You sort of
I would agree you're innovative, and for another reason that it be, in that context it's easier to introduce variables that are important for people like me, whatever that means. I'm the kind of person who, when I read, and I know all readers have experienced this, they'll kind of drift into thinking about something and they'll kind of forget where they were reading. I happen to do that after a sentence or two, just constantly. So to the extent that the presentation of the material can be supplemented with music or image or, you know, anything that can kind of combat that tendency of my brain. I think you'd grow your numbers of readers essentially.
I've talked to people who have had attention deficit disorders that made it impossible for them to read because they got so distracted.
Yes.
And they found that reading on a very small screen like an iPhone helped them to read more. Have you had any of that kind of experience?
It's funny, most of my reading happens to be just as a consequence of my business travel and interacting with devices. So that may be happening without even knowing it. So you may have made me conscious of something that I'll start thinking about.
Now, and let's see, there's so much going on in my head. It's like I'm reading a book and I'm getting distracted. But it's not a discouraging message that you gave in there. It's saying that people who love to read, the curling up with a novel, great, that's art. And but you're looking for a day maybe when there's just less of a kind of autocratic view,
yeah,
that it's a privileged way to
exactly
convey meaning.
I mean, and if you'll forgive my soapboxing just for a minute, I mean, this would be the context for doing it. I've always found that despite, I think and hope, being able to hold my own in an intellectual discussion, when I've reported not having learned something from reading, I'm instantly, it's suspect, instantly. And it baffles me that something I might learn from a video game or a song or a conversation, or I just learned something a minute ago in our conversation, was not elicited in print, in text, how that's somehow denigrated in any, you know, and I think increasingly, for whatever reason, there are growing segments of people who are not getting all of their information in a typeset context, right? So I think the quicker the moral, the kind of the normative issue, the sense that one is better than the other kind of goes away, I think we can all kind of come together around just loving meaning and loving stories and loving narrative, right? Because that's the stuff on top. The things we're here quibbling about, the delivery of the information, but the truth is, that's why I called it a technology. Those are tools for something much more important, much larger, that floats on the surface, that I think we can all hold hands and appreciate, essentially.
How did reading get that kind of moral weight and advantage over other forms of information?
I suspect it's around it's about class and money and people having been educated, and a literate class versus an illiterate class. And the literate classes, you know, opened the universities and controlled the cultural agenda. I think technology is starting to disrupt that. You start looking at figures of illiteracy around the world, and I think you start talking about artists who may not be literate, but who offer something, you know, potentially offer something very powerful to the world. And I think it's something, I don't think it's conscious. I think it's something we can all appreciate. I think I'm hoping at some level to raise consciousness about that so that we can kind of think about that. Even just before my session, I was sitting next to the gentleman who spoke before me, who's a brilliant guy. I said something, he started talking about something, and I said, oh yeah, I watched a video about that, and he kind of laughed. So it's just so ingrained to think, there's something about not having learned it from a book that somehow minimizes its value. It's very strange once you notice it and you start being conscious of it.
For some reason, I get the image of a race between a horse and a horseless carriage, or John Henry and the pile driver. Have you ever gone kind of mano a mano against a really book-educated person, and they didn't know that you were not book-educated, or maybe they did, and you beat him?
I mean, so much of any academic work I've done has been in philosophy. When I don't know that they'd say this, but I suspect that even the scholars, you know, when you're talking about the Critique of Reason by Immanuel Kant, you tend to talk about 10 or 12 paragraphs, like the B deduction of the Kant, where no one's reading that whole book. You know, even the guys who are writing the books about these books, are they really reading all that shit? But they probably are. But still, I mean, your point is well taken. I think there's, again, it's about the meanings that are elicited by the symbols, and those can come in any number of ways. And it's interesting to me that we would privilege one over the other.
Do you have any children?
I have two children.
Are you teaching them to read?
We are. I think learning to read is critical, obviously.
Why?
Because if you don't have a concept of something, it's hard to see it. There's a lot of work in the philosophy of language that talks about the primacy of language in the way that understanding an idea allows allows your mind to see instances of it in the world. And I think it's easy examples are in the sciences, for instance. Once you start to understand what momentum and centripetal force are, you look at the world perhaps a little differently. And I think the same thing can happen with literary ideas. So it's important to me that, another way I should say it is, and I don't know if it hurts or helps my argument, but there was a recent video and article in The Economist, which essentially said, the number of words a child hears between age 0 and 3 will determine their IQ and how smart they are later in life. So that's to me an argument about hearing things. But I think teaching my daughters to read is an important aspect of hearing and even understanding what they're hearing. On the other hand, so I am teaching them to read, but I will say, and this may run contrary to a lot of your readers or listeners' disposition, is I'm extremely happy with them watching video as much as they want. Probably, I mean, even I start to think about it. I'm like, at what point do I, you know, they've been watching for 3 hours straight on their iPad. Should I think about that? And my inclination is no. But I'm so part of this culture that the fact that I'm even asking myself that suggests that this idea of privileging one style of content over the other is so manifest, it's hard to escape.
Are you tempted to write a book about this?
I am. Very much so.
But you'll never read it?
Perhaps.
I have a great advantage when I go to South by Southwest in that I'm able to stay at the home of my cousin, Peter, and he's got a nice guest room, and he's been told by his friends that does he really realize how much he could earn renting out that room during South by Southwest, and I'm always a little nervous about knowing the value of what he's offering so freely, but I do try to make sure that we get to go out to dinner at some of his favorite restaurants, and each morning when I was there, we went to a coffee shop near his house called Kneaded Pleasures, K-N-E-A-D-E-D Pleasures, which had some great croissants and a good chance for us to catch up. After those conversations that I had at South by Southwest about reading and the guy who, Ed Castillo, who admitted that he hasn't read a book, Peter and I were talking about reading, and he's got a fascinating perspective because he's blind, and so his reading is done in altogether different media than sighted people's. And so we chewed this over one morning on our way to coffee.
I'm Peter Tai. I'm totally blind, and I'm more or less retired, but my specialty is adaptive equipment for the blind, training and installation and the use of it.
Now, I heard some pretty radical ideas about the book for sighted people at South by Southwest yesterday and at dinner last night. We had a conversation about what it's like for blind people and whether when you read a book in Braille, you feel like you have really read the book compared to listening to it in some audio format.
Braille is kind of slow, or at least it is for me, and so I do a lot of listening. So I wouldn't say that you have to have read a book in Braille as a blind person in order to really absorb it, but you have to listen to it very carefully in order to have absorbed it. And I think what provoked me about your discussion of this person who got all his learning from sort of auxiliary sources, by listening, by going to a lecture here and there, picking it up on NPR, all the sorts of things that they get it without going directly to books or articles, reminded me of a lot of blind people who I feel are sort of picking things up on the fly, perhaps drawing conclusions more that they shouldn't be, and it's not a very nice thing to say, sort of bullshitting the world because they haven't really got it all together and they haven't read the source really carefully.
So you would come down on the side of it, you really need to read the book to get the ability to talk about it.
That's right. And if you're going to, you don't necessarily, as a blind person, have to read in Braille. You can listen to it, but you need to listen to it carefully, not just tangentially as you're washing the dishes.
Well, now, given that the important thing is to read the book, are there differences, do you think, in your intake of material that you read if you're reading it with your fingers in Braille versus hearing it?
A little bit. I think that you can concentrate a little bit more. A dumb thing, if you shout a phone number at me, I'm likely to remember it because I'm used to remembering things like that. But if I pass my fingers through a 3x5 card that has a phone number on it, it delves into my brain a little bit better. It's a little easier to remember. And also, I think if you're reading a passage, it's a beautiful passage, a poem or biblical passage or something that's important to you, it can stick a little better in your mind if you read it through with Braille than if it's just spoken through synthetic speech or a tape or an audible book.
One of the things I've heard a lot in this last 5 years from people who are resisting the move toward ebooks is that they love the feel of the book. And I think that when you read in Braille, that term means even more than it does for a sighted person who's holding a book.
Well, maybe so, although there's something about the paper and the smell of the paper. The Braille is actually kind of a rough surface, so I don't think I have any sort of mysticism of the paper with the Braille in front of me. The issue is, does the Braille allow it to sink in to my head and to think about it a little more deeply? And I think it may at times.
Why do you think that might be?
Well, because you're really reading it rather than just hearing it on across the room on NPR or PBS, that there's an element of literacy. For example, in Braille, you have to be able to spell and figure out what letters mean for words, and so there's a translation process there that I think can give you a deeper feeling of it, rather than if you just hear it pass by you.
Maybe more parts of your brain are engaged,
yeah,
because of the need to understand grammar and spelling, things like that.
Right.
Well, on behalf of the Kindle Chronicles listeners, I want to thank you for the accommodations here during South by Southwest. And as usual, I'll be treating you for breakfast at Needed Pleasure, so we probably need to be on our way.
I think so. Great.
Without my planning it, this issue of people who don't read books turned out to be kind of a theme throughout South by Southwest, so much so that the last interview I did on Tuesday, the day I flew back to Denver, was with one of the top podcasters in the country, Adam Carolla. And I spoke with him after a session that he gave, which was really quite an important one for podcasters, because he's fighting a patent troll who has claimed ownership of an obscure part of the podcasting technology, and he's trying to raise $1 million in a crowdfunded effort to pay legal fees to fight this. So I'm going to have links to this because I think it's an important battle for those of us who care about the future of podcasting, and he's waging a good battle on this. I spoke with him briefly after the talk, and it turned out that he too had a story to tell about the difficulty of reading books.
My name is Adam Carolla, and I'm a podcaster and a carpenter.
You have a book coming out in May?
You have a book called President Me coming out in May, and if you liked my last two books, which was In 50 Years We'll All Be Chicks and Not Taco Bell Material, and I think you'll enjoy this one. And if you didn't enjoy those, you're still going to enjoy this one.
I see it's available for pre-order on Kindle. My listeners are all Kindle readers. Are you reading on a Kindle yourself?
I'm not a reader. I'm a bad reader, I'm a slow reader, I'm a poor reader. So, to be honest, I do the audiobook thing. And basically, I don't, you know, it's weird. I don't have any time. My schedule's insane, and I work a ton. And so, basically, I listen to classical music and I write. I do a lot of writing. So if I had a couple hours to spare, I would probably write versus read. So I'd rather just sort of create than absorb, I guess, without sounding like a snob. But I always have projects going. I'm constantly working on those projects, and thus I really don't do any reading.
Did you read earlier when you weren't quite so busy?
No. I've always been a horrible reader. I never really learned to read. People thought that I was dyslexic or something. It's always funny because I always joke that when you're a white guy and you can't read, you're dyslexic. When you're black and you can't read, you fell through the cracks or the system let you down. And I always thought it's kind of racist. Like, maybe there's some black folks that are dyslexic and why is it the system? But I was one of those guys who just fell through the cracks, never, you know, just sort of warehoused at school. I never learned to read. And it was fine because I got into construction and I never had to read.
I've had some people tell me who are dyslexic or have other reading problems that it's easier to read on an ebook. Have you ever tried a Kindle to see if it seems easier than what you remember?
No, but I will now. Yeah. I mean, now that you've prompted me.
It's fewer words at a time, so it seems easier.
Oh, yeah, because I do get lost when I look at that huge page. Yeah.
Cool. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Next up, a couple of voices from the UK. I stopped by the UK Demo Day at the Hilton across the street from the convention center, and they had some startup companies that were displaying their wares, and so I had a chance to meet a few people there. Don't have time to play all of those conversations, but I'll give you one from Luke Littleboy. And then while I was waiting for a larger session, I ended up sitting next to a fellow from the BBC and had a conversation with him. So here are a couple of people I met from the UK.
My name's Luke Littleboy. I work for Screenburn Media in the UK. We're a London-based tech startup, and we allow the sale of long-form content like films, concert films, and that kind of thing through a Facebook page. So it's an app that sits directly on perhaps an artist's Facebook page, and then you can sell movies to your fans.
And you're the marketing guy?
I'm the marketing manager, yes. My friend Tom, we went to school together. He's the founder. And then we did a round of angel investment late last year in 2013. Then Tom brought me on board to help out with marketing.
Now, when you survey opportunities to reach out to new markets, you said that somewhere on the horizon might be the idea of an ebook. How difficult do you think that would be, and what tools would you even look to investigate based on what you know about that space now?
I mean, I'm at fairly early stages in investigating that kind of thing, but I certainly have some friends, and I've read some articles on Kindle Direct Publishing, and it looks like a process that I'd happily get involved in. From our point of view, if we were going to make an ebook that might help out perhaps an independent filmmaker on how to get their film distributed online, we could obviously help out with that. We could allow them to distribute their film through Facebook to their fans. So I'd certainly look to perhaps using the Kindle direct upload to create an ebook around a subject like that to help out the consumer.
And for your purposes, it would be an ebook that you would hope to distribute at no cost?
Yeah, I think it would definitely be something we'd do for free. We'd look at it as a piece of content marketing, I think. Something that's relatively unbiased and not too salesy, but something that would definitely help out the consumer and be useful to them, something that they could actually take away and, with some good actions that they can take away for themselves.
How about your own reading? Are you using a Kindle or another e-reader?
Yeah, I am. I must admit. So as a younger guy, as a teenager, I used to read a lot of books, a lot of novels. But in recent years, I'd stopped reading. But since I got a Kindle for Christmas, actually, from my parents, I've started to read tremendously again. I've been even going back and revisiting a lot of books. And also, from my point of view as well, I've been reading a lot of books on, social media marketing and digital marketing as well. So it's been really, really helpful. So I'm based in London, and, obviously I spend a lot of time on the Tube. But it's a really good way to pass the time on the Tube. And I know it sounds a bit cheesy, but it's definitely helped me rediscover reading.
I'm James Montgomery. I'm Director of Digital for BBC Global News.
What's the most intriguing or useful thing you've learned so far at South by Southwest?
I've been before, and I don't think I've had a kind of eureka moment or a kind of revelatory experience in the way that perhaps one hopes for. I've been to a number of really interesting panels and sessions, and I think the one that sticks in my mind, as you asked the question, is one I went to yesterday with Upworthy, a workshop, sort of 2 hours, where we got a really deep dive into how they do social sharing and content optimization, and I found that very useful.
I'm not familiar with Upworthy. What do they do?
Upworthy is a social aggregation site, a bit like BuzzFeed, that finds what they think is good content on the web and that does a really great job of promoting it and optimizing it for social sharing amongst their audience.
Now, I assume the BBC is active in kind of ebook space, bringing content to shorter ebooks. It seems like a lot of the publications and news organizations in the US are doing that. Is that a pretty active area for the BBC?
I would say not terribly. The BBC does many things, but text publishing, even on digital platforms, is probably not our forte. I can think of other publishing houses in the UK that do that much better, like Penguin or something. We have looked at it, and we've certainly looked at how we can kind of package content so that it has a longer shelf life. In the news division where I work, that's challenging because news tends to be sort of perishable. But it's something we'd like to understand better because we also feel that sometimes over a big arc of a story like, I don't know, the war in Iraq or the crisis in Ukraine, there ought to be a way of packaging all of our daily reporting in a format that allows you to read the, you know, the long story arc as well as the daily news.
How about your own personal reading? Are you using an e-reader?
I confess I don't. I read a lot on the web through apps and mobile. I'm fairly addicted to my smartphone and my iPad, but I haven't used e-books much. I find, you know, when I'm reading for pleasure, I actually sometimes quite like a screen break, and therefore an actual, you know, printed paper book sometimes is welcome just because it gives your eyes a bit of a rest or a little bit of variation. I guess I spend a good part of my working day or my waking hours, in fact, looking at screens. Occasionally your eyes just get tired, and to go back to paper sometimes is a nice change. But I see the opportunity. Certainly when I'm traveling, I always pack it on my screen. I don't take books when I'm traveling. And I think there's, as the screens get better and the experiences get better, I think there are opportunities to do more. And I'm particularly interested not so much in, you know, text on a screen like a Kindle, but the kind of the multimedia experiences with graphics and video. And I think that's a hugely exciting opportunity, and one that the BBC will definitely be exploring.
For content, I want to return to the work of Austin Kleon. He has a book which was just published last week called Show Your Work, 10 Ways to Share Your Creativity and Get Discovered. It follows an earlier book that was called Steal Like an Artist, 10 Things Nobody Told You About Being Creative. And that one's been hugely popular. When I've been reading that on my Kindle, some of the passages have been highlighted more than 1,000 times, which is something I very rarely see in a Kindle book. So when I read these books and see the response they've gotten, it makes it not much of a surprise to see that many people in Exhibit Hall 5 when I stumbled into his session on the first day of South by Southwest. I just finished the most recent book. And, you know, sometimes these books that are, they look simple because there are a lot of things in them which are common sense, but maybe it just depends on when you read them. I remember reading some books by Seth Godin that way, and it's you can say, well, gee, this is obvious, but then you can say, if it's obvious, how come so many people have benefited from it and gone on to do good work because of it? E-books for Troops came out of reading a book by Seth Godin 4 years ago, very directly. So I have a similar sense to this Show Your Work book by Austin Kleon. One thing which struck me when I heard it, and also when I read the book yesterday and today, is this myth that the artist is a solitary figure, and if you're not a brilliant like Picasso, or in this business, Leo Laporte, what's the point? There's only a few people that are revealed as individual geniuses, and they're the ones that everybody looks up to. No, he's saying that if you're engaged in a creative process, you need to follow your passion and do work which you really care about, which excites you, and then to share the process of it. And that, I think, was the most helpful thing to me, is the idea of reaching out to people who are doing similar work, people who are, in my case, involved in the ebook revolution. And a lot of this I have done in reaching out to fellow Kindle bloggers like Andrew Spaston and Stephen Windwalker and Bufo Calvin. And there's a group of us that have been doing this for quite a while, and I do feel like that's a community. But I haven't been doing so much of the share the process of the work, which was kind of at the core of this latest book. I would offer the books of Austin Kleon as the content, and I would also recommend, if you have a chance to go to South by Southwest in some future year, it's a great place to get charged up with new ideas and energy. That certainly has happened to me every time I've gone down there. And thanks to Peter for being a great host, and to all the people I met. I have a lot of other stories I wished I'd had time to tell, but I think you've got a pretty good taste of the highlights.
I'm not sure who my guest is going to be next week. I did reach out to Austin Kleon to see if he might be available for an interview, but he's obviously a very busy fellow these days. And I'm also trying to get an interview with the CEO of Spritz, which is that new reading technology that shoots one word at a time at you. Turns out it's a Boston company. So I might be able to get a chance to visit with them when I'm out in Boston later this month. This is Len Edgerly for the Kindle Chronicles in downtown Denver, Colorado. I really appreciate your taking the time to listen to my podcast. Have a great day. Bye.